Hello, I'm David Remnick of The New Yorker magazine, and you're listening to New York and Company with Leonard Lopate on AM 820 WNYC Radio, New York.
I'm sure you're aware by now that the book business is shrinking. Five conglomerates currently control 80% of all American sales. Most people in the industry will tell you that's nothing to be alarmed about, that there were many works of quality among the 70,000 books published in the U.S. last year. Well, Andre Schifrin is one insider who disagrees. As the managing director of Pantheon for 30 years and the founding manager of the New Press since 1990, he's been a witness to what he feels is a disturbing lowering of standards in publishing. Mr. Schifrin has written The Business of Books, Part Memoir, Part History, just out from Verso, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to New York and Company today. Hello.
Hello, and it's great to be here.
And this is not published by you. It's published by Verso, another small independent company.
Right. In fact, Verso suggested that I write the book, which I hadn't intended to at this point, and it shows the role that the smaller presses are really taking these days in coming up with ideas for controversial new books.
Well, since the small presses still represent 20% of the books sold, and that's not bad, one in five
well,
books.
Well, no, I'm afraid that's not the case, because the five conglomerates control 80%, but if you take the 20 top firms, they're up to 93%. You add another 2% for the university presses, that leaves you 5% for everybody else. And that includes all sorts of medium-sized firms and so on. So the small presses really have less than 1%.
Can it be said that you were born into the publishing business?
In a way, my father was a publisher, but for that very reason, I thought I wouldn't be in publishing myself. You're always afraid of following in your father's footsteps. But he died when I was very young, and I say in the book that I inadvertently ended up following in a very different kind of publishing world.
Well, he was one of a number of Jewish emigres from Hitler who started up a quality publishing house.
Right. He helped to start Pantheon Books in 1942, shortly after we had come to the U.S. with Kurt Wolff and his wife Helen, and Pantheon was for many years a very distinguished firm. There were a whole bunch of emigre publishing houses at that time, most of which disappeared after the war.
And were they bringing something different, a different sensibility to American publishing? After all, there was some pretty great American literature before the emigres came.
Right, and the emigrant firms, for the most part, really didn't publish American literature. They were trying to publish some of the European books that were being written at the time or that were unknown in the U.S., so that while Alfred Knopf and a number of other firms had done a good job of translating the best-known of the European writers, there were still a great many that weren't known, and that's what Pantheon and the others concentrated on.
Knopf had a kind of an inside track because of his European connections, so he wound up with Thomas Mann and writers like that.
Right, but he wasn't the only one. In fact, one of the interesting changes that has taken place in American publishing is that every major house that was worth a damn felt they really should translate major writing, and whether it was Simon Schuster or Knopf or many of the houses that have disappeared, like Smith and Haas and so on, people were looking for important European writing in the way they no longer are.
But you say that the European publishers who then came here and started publishing were looking at publishing a little differently. So not only were there lots of translations, but there also were more political histories, a lot of European social theory that might not have been published otherwise.
Right. There was also the contemporary resistance writing. My father published some of the books that were being published by the French underground at the time, books that later became classics, and some like Camus the Stranger that were published first in French by him before they were translated into English. So there was a certain amount of traffic going on between occupied Europe and the U.S. And, of course, you had exiled writers like Hermann Broch and others who came here and continued to write.
And was that the goal of your father and the Wolfs, to publish these European writers who might not otherwise be published in the United States?
Right. That was an important part of it. And I think they also felt strongly that America had to continue to have some idea of what was going on in Europe and what was going on intellectually. And, of course, after the war, there was a period where everyone was very interested. The New York Times used to run a regular literary letter from Prague or Paris or Dublin or whatever practically once a month. There was a lot more coverage. And the Times today had an article on the French literary scene, which I think is literally the first time that arts and leisure section has had anything in memory on that.
And the French literary scene is one of the few that continues to thrive in a non-American way.
Right. Well, Europe has still maintained, in spite of the importance of the conglomerates there, and that's something we can discuss in detail.
Which we will get to.
The major houses are still the ones that aren't owned by the conglomerates, and major in terms of content, and they more or less set the stage.
Now, was it possible to publish some of these obscure writers and European political and social thought and still turn a profit?
No, absolutely not. And it was only by very good luck that towards the end of its first phase, Pantheon published a Russian novel by a then relatively unknown author, a book called Dr. Zhivago, of which the first printing was 4,000, and that was the right printing. That's exactly what they should have printed, maybe a little optimistic. They ended up selling over 1 million copies in hardcover and 5 in paper, and that transformed the firm into something very different. But until then, they hadn't made a nickel.
And when a firm gets transformed with a Dr. Zhivago, doesn't it start looking for more Dr. Zhivagos?
Well, it does, and Pantheon had the good luck of finding The Leopard and The Tin Drum and a number of other important books at that stage. But it also is a time when the stockholders begin to say, oh, well, maybe this is the time to sell out. This is something we'd invested in as a good deed, basically, and suddenly we can make big bucks out of it. So they sold.
Your most recent venture, The New Press, is nonprofit. Can you make a go of it simply on sales?
We have never been in the red for in any of the 10 years we've been working, and we believe strongly that a not-for-profit framework is a better way to publish because of the enormous pressures, which we'll talk about later, that come from being owned by a conglomerate. But we have foundation help, and we have foundation help, which in a way we call a scholarship fund, so that just as a student should be admitted to a college on the promise of what he's going to do rather than how much money he's going to earn, so we take on books that we know are going to lose money.
On the other hand, you brought over from Pantheon some of your most famous writers, people who had guaranteed decent sales.
Right, and that helped us a lot. Stud Sterkel's book on race was the first book we did at the New Press, and it helped to establish us as a serious player and a publisher that would have some bestsellers as well as a lot of very good lesser-selling titles. One of the things that's important and very heartening to me is that of all the hundreds and hundreds of people we published at Pantheon over the years, only, I think, 3 opted to stay with Random House.
And the rest came over to the New Press.
The rest either came to us or
went
elsewhere.
My guest is Andre Schifrin. He's written a book called The Business of Books. It's published by Verso. So I wonder about what the people you brought up from Pantheon represent in sales for you. Are they your main... your mainstay, or because you've done some very experimental things, like you did the Supreme Court transcripts,
and that's of course one of the lessons you learn in publishing is that you can't really be sure what's going to be a bestseller, and you can't always expect your salespeople to know. So that while we knew that Stud Sterkel's books would be bestsellers, as indeed they have been, there are other books which we took on thinking they would sell very modestly. We did the Supreme Court's greatest hits, The Maid Please the Court, which was an experiment, really. It was both a text and then 6 cassettes with the actual recordings that were made, unbeknownst to many of the lawyers, by the way, of the major cases since 1956. And all of our salespeople and outside advisors said, you know, this is only for law professors.
Let's get back. And then it sold well.
And then it sold 75,000 sets.
But I'm concerned about the whole idea that large publishing firms are a bad thing. Haven't huge publishing companies dominated the American book business from the start? In the 19th century, Harper has published many mass market books. It also published Moby Dick and other works of quality.
Right, and for many, many years, until these last 20 years, as I say, most publishers didn't expect to make money out of trade books. The profit would come in later from book clubs and paperbacks and subsidiary rights of different sorts.
And balancing the Stephen Kings, the Michael Crichtons, and the Danielle Steeles with the books that they felt had literary merit.
Right, exactly. And that was the serving both both the the church and the state, as it were, being able to do both. It was a key part of what publishing was about. But that was also because the profits, the overall profits that were expected, were relatively reasonable. If you look at all of American publishing for all of the 20th century until recent years, the average annual profit was 45%. And if that's what you're looking for, and you're going to make your money from the growth of the firm, and Alf Knopf did not, retire a poor man, nor will Roger Strauss, if you're looking for a reasonable profit, you can do that. And that's what the European houses still do. But if you're looking for the profits the conglomerates want, then you change the whole picture.
But the publishing houses are a teeny part of these conglomerates.
Right.
Time Warner really, 99% of its money is earned outside
right.
of publishing.
Indeed. And I looked when I saw the figure of the AOL merger of $165 billion, of which Time Warner was at best $1 billion, and they got to that number by stretching it. In other words, about half of 1%. You wonder. But the problem is that the large conglomerates are going to expect the small components to make as much money as the large. And at the same time, it's going to be very hard to persuade your owners that you should be the source of greater investment. Why pour a lot of money into something that's going to at best add a tiny percentage to the overall picture? So the publishing houses that are owned by conglomerates are in a bind. They have to make as much money as the other parts, and they're going to have less of a draw on the resources of their huge owners.
You point out that many of the bestsellers of the turn of the 19th century have become the literary classics of today. Now, what's happened? Did people have more refined tastes then?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, you look not only at the bestsellers, but the books that were most borrowed from the libraries, and you'll see that people were reading Balzac and Dickens and Scott and so on. And to some degree, that is no longer the case. That's true. And
was Henry James selling books well?
No, I don't think Henry James sold quite as well. But on the other hand, it's a respectable list. Tolstoy sold very well in the U.S. when he first came out at the end of the century. And books sold in huge, huge numbers. I mean, you're talking, when you adjust for population, the equivalent of millions of copies today.
Considering the fact that there was a high illiteracy rate, that's even
right.
more remarkable.
Even higher, right.
Maybe that's the reason. Perhaps the people who are reading were people who were better educated.
It's interesting. There hasn't been much written on the history of American reading, which is a shame. But we know that, for instance, when Uncle Tom's Cabin appeared, miners the gold miners in California were renting it each night for 2 bits a night, 25 cents a night, which is a lot of money. So all sorts of people were reading. And, in fact, part of what publishing was trying to do in the U.S. and elsewhere was to reach the broadest audience. So you had books like Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward selling in the millions, Henry George, people who had socialist utopian schemes of one kind or another, really made an impact. And that was in part because the publishers believed in trying to reach a mass audience. They hadn't written it off or said, oh, well, they're only going to be interested in the Jerry Springer picture book, as Harper published recently. So it is partly expectation. It's partly you have respect for your audience. You have respect for the people you're publishing for.
How long did that last? Did that continue well into the century? Into the 20th century?
Yeah.
I'm still saying this century
right.
for the 20th
right.
century.
Right, right. Well, I started out in publishing in the 50s for a mass market publisher called New American Library, and I write about that in the book in terms of their relatively idealistic attitude. I mean, they published Forever Amber and they published Mickey Spillane. I don't want to glorify them, but they also published a serious nonfiction. They published Sweden the Middle Way. They published Coming of Age in Samoa. They published all sorts of books. I remember as a kid actually buying a book called The Christian Demand for Social Justice. That's not a book you'd find on your airport stand these days. So there was partly because NAL was the leader in this field, and also because they inherited the tradition of Penguin books in England. They had belonged to Penguin initially. There was a strong, well, practically missionary zeal. There was the feeling that people had a right to know, they had a right to read the best stuff that was available cheaply. Books then cost the price of a pack of cigarettes. Now, they cost several times the cost of a pack of cigarettes, and the paper costs have not gone up that much.
I used to buy those paperbacks, the Signets and the NALs,
right.
for 25 cents.
Exactly. They were 25 and 35 cents. And that means they reached a very broad public. And part of the change has been really, as I say, the lack of respect for the people who buy inexpensive books. I mean, now they're really fed a steady stream of drivel and trivia, and it's assumed that they're not going to be interested in reading the new Thomas Mann.
Andre Schifrin's The Business of Books is published by Verso. We will continue our conversation here on AMA 20 WNYC, live online at WNYC.org right after this. We're back with Andre Schifrin, who was for 30 years managing director at Pantheon. He is now director of the New Press, which he founded in 1990, and he also writes about publishing in the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's written a book called The Business of Books. It's published by Verso. So why did you even go to the New American Library if you were trying to stay out of the family business?
Well, I was interested in politics. I was interested in public debate. I was interested in getting ideas out to a broader audience. And in a way, NAL seemed one of the ways of doing that.
What had you thought you were going to do when you were going to school?
I actually thought I would become an academic until I went to graduate school, and that cured me of that forever.
Well, you went to Cambridge.
I went to Cambridge, which was graduate school in a way, but it was also a marvelous two-year vacation, which was about as enjoyable a time as I've had in my life. But then I went on to Columbia for several more years trying to get a PhD, and that turned me off the academy forever.
When you were in England, didn't you become the first American editor of the British literary magazine Grant?
Right, which at that time was a student magazine, and it was a different kind of student magazine in that it had a national audience, and we published professors as well as students, and we published many of the people who have since become very well known.
I'm curious about how much of editing and publishing is really a matter of networking.
Well, it's interesting.
Because you met so many important people when you were doing Grant.
Right, but many of them we continued to publish afterwards, and some of whom, like David Frost, became famous for other things than writing books. Mark Twain used to say, put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. Well, Cambridge and Oxford were the baskets that England put all their eggs into, so it was an extraordinary concentration of talent, and you just had to stand there, and you would meet some interesting people. But also what we did with Granta was to begin what they've done ever since, really, was to have themes around each issue, and many of the people who wrote on those themes, whether they're professors or students, have gone on to do extremely interesting work.
So eventually you decided to go into the family firm, Pantheon, 1961. Now, there were no Schifrins in the company at the time.
No, and it was no longer anything resembling a family firm. As I said, my father died when I was very young, 15, and I never thought I lost all links to Pantheon. I never thought I would work there.
So it was just coincidental?
Well, no, it wasn't coincidental. It was a moment in time when Pantheon had just been bought by Random House, and they realized that they really needed somebody there called an editor, which they didn't have since the Wolfs had left.
And Random House was then the largest publisher in America.
It was certainly one of the largest, and in fact so large that when it merged with Knopf, the Attorney General was on the phone saying, what's the meaning of all of this? And then very miffed to discover that the firm was only worth $15 million altogether. And one of the interesting changes is that when Time Warner AOL came into being, or when indeed Bertelsmann bought Random House for $1.5 billion, no one from the Attorney General's office was on the phone. And that's, of course, the key change that has allowed all this to happen.
Now, when Random House bought Pantheon, was there any agreement struck for Pantheon to maintain its independence, to remain the kind of publisher it had established itself as?
Nothing formally. I don't think there was anything on paper at all. When you sell something, you lose all control of it. But the partners who ran Random House at the time, Bennett Cerf and Donald Klopfer and Bob Haas, whose name has been forgotten, were very eager to have Pantheon continue, and they wanted to start a new generation. I think they felt they were growing a new Knopf, as it were, and they were incredibly supportive, and it was marvelous working for people who were such great book people, so that when you think of Bennett Cerf, if you do at all these days, you think of someone who was known for his show business ties and for his What's My Line appearances on
The Father of Christopher.
And The Father of Christopher, of course, which is a very different kind of and very respectable kind of show business indeed. But Bennett was a very serious publisher. You know, he had courted Gertrude Stein, and he'd brought James Joyce onto the Random House list and so on. And they liked the idea of a small firm that would not concentrate on making as much money as possible, but it was getting the best books possible.
So it was a long time before you started being pressured to publish fewer difficult titles?
It was a very long time, which allowed us to build Pantheon into something that was really an important publishing house, if I say that. Myself, we published a lot of people, whether it was Chomsky or Foucault or Gunnar Myrdal or whoever, who would not have been published readily in the U.S. otherwise. And it was only when RCA took over Random House that, you know, that the budgets began to become more important. And then as time passed, under Newhouse, of course, it became all important. And it reached the stage, which I describe in the book, where not only the pressures of budget, but the pressures of ideology made us think that we couldn't continue.
Well, were they concerned that there was also a kind of a leftist side
very,
to the
very much?
I mean, you had George Kennan, who's probably the farthest to the right,
right
of all of the people you were publishing.
Right. Well, we had Kennan, we had McNamara as well, and a number of other.
But you had R.D. Lang, right. Myrdal, you said Eric Hobsbawm, a right. Marxist historian, E.P. Thompson, Studs Terkel, Ralph Nader.
Right. Now, we had a list that was certainly far to the left of what Cy Newhouse himself was comfortable with. And as his own biographers have shown in various books, Cy was very conservative from his college days on. He was a great friend of Roy Cohn. He was not happy. He was not comfortable with this kind of publishing. And when we were negotiating at the end, we were told bluntly, though they denied it afterwards, to stop publishing so many books that were on the left and to publish more on the right.
But you were also doing over $20 million in business annually. And that seems to me to be a good thing for business.
It was a good thing for business.
Unless you were losing 25.
Right, exactly. No, we were managing to break even or make a little money each year. But, you know, $20 million to sign was the cost of a Jasper Johns, and he had sold one at a considerable loss. I joked at the time that it never occurred to him to burn the Jasper Johns when he got tired of it, which is, in effect, what they did with Pantheon. They destroyed it rather than allow it to continue in a way they disapproved of. But, you know, the overall Random total was close to $1 billion at that time, so we were a very small percentage.
But much was made of the literary independence of your successor at Pantheon, Errol MacDonald. Was that all just for show?
I think I can only judge what I see in the catalogs, and I haven't seen any real manifestations of intellectual independence in that. In fact, I know that when we left, Fred Jordan, who was with Errol, put in place, told the staff that they were to stop publishing political stuff, and they did indeed stop doing so overall. So the kind of publishing we had tried to do more or less went away.
So they've ignored the catalog? They still publish Art Spiegelman's Mouse, don't they?
Right. Well, Art Spiegelman's book, which I was very proud to publish, has sold over, you know, several hundred thousand copies, so that you don't throw those away. But they did throw away a lot of very good stuff, and they put out of print a huge amount. And it's the list is indistinguishable, as it should be, from that of Knopf, because it's the head of Knopf, Sonny Mehta, who decides what will go into it. So it's, in effect, it's part of Knopf at this point.
My guest is Andre Schifrin, and his book is The Business of Books. It's published by Verso. This is AMA 20 WNYC, live online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So Random House is now still owned by Cy Newhouse, or has it moved on again?
Right. Well, that was, of course, the major change the other year, and it was an interesting change in that when Vitaly and Newhouse took over at the time that Bernstein left, and Bernstein, the former head of Random House, and then shortly thereafter we left, it was declared that they would have a totally new policy, that they were going to be hard-nosed, make a lot of money. Vitaly offered to make huge profits and so on. And it must be said, the New York Times and a lot of other papers applauded this. They said, oh, well, publishing is too serious a thing to be left to intellectuals. You really have to have tough businessmen and so on. And a lot of changes were put into place. The lists were changed very considerably. Whole areas were jettisoned. And the result was that they lost more money than they'd ever lost before.
Now, similar things happened in the music business. The big music companies only went after hits, mm-hmm. got rid of all the things that might have been called quality. But the slack was picked up by independents. Why aren't there more independents in the book business?
Well, there are. There are hundreds of independents in the book business.
But they don't seem to suddenly, they don't seem to rise to the prominence that some of those independent record companies do. Are the economics of the book business so much more difficult?
Well, I think in many respects they are. I mean, there are similarities with the music business as there are with the film business, and we could talk about that. The other media, I think they've become very similar.
All owned by the same conglomerates.
All owned by the same people. And, you know, I want to stress above all that the major shift that happened in publishing was not that the people who'd been there all these years said, oh, we're not interested in good books anymore, but that the people in charge of the firms, the financial people, said, look, you've been making 4% all these years. That's not acceptable. We want you to make 12 or 15 or 20. And when you do that, you have to change the nature of what you're publishing.
But the whole idea of all of these companies except Bertelsmann, which is only in publishing, mm-hmm. was synergy, wasn't it? When Disney owns a publishing house, it owns a magazine, a bunch of magazines. It owns a movie production, one of the largest Hollywood studios. Things could all be intertwined, and things could be, more profit could be squeezed out of things.
That was the idea, and you have only to look at Talk Magazine
and Miramax, which is owned by Disney.
Right, and see how many movies have come out of that and how many ideas have been developed from books into movies and vice versa, to see how very difficult it is going to be to do that. I don't see a major motion picture coming out about Martin Amis's teeth, at least not at this point, though you never know. It might make a good animated film.
What about when Martin Amis dated Tina Brown?
Right. Well, you could have a short subject on that, I suppose, but I don't know the details enough to know if there's a real story.
But that was the idea, wasn't it?
That was the idea, but it was the idea when RCA bought Random House and when Raytheon and CBS bought their publishing houses back in the 70s, and it didn't work. It didn't work. In those days, it was thought that the publishing houses would feed the software into the teaching machines, which were early versions of the computers, and none of that worked at all. I think the difficulty is that there's, you know, if everybody in the world for decade after decade try to make more than 4% and fail to do so, it tells you something about the nature of the business. And the only way you can change that is by changing the nature of the books you're publishing. So that, you know, Harper, Collins last year started something called Harper Entertainment, which was an obvious attempt to put the firm more into the Fox 5, etc. framework, and they announced 136 entertainment books, including the Jerry Springer book I mentioned. Now, Harper and Row, you know, used to publish literally 136 or more books in politics and history and social science and theology and so on. Those have all disappeared.
But Harper also, a few years ago, started Harper Flamingo, with people like Russell Banks and Oscar Wilde.
Right. No, I think every firm has tried, particularly in paper, to make the best of the literary authors that they still have and who are still profitable, and they can publish those well, and they do. But what's interesting is to see how the whole shift in nonfiction has taken place.
You think the real problem is in nonfiction, difficult books are less likely to be published, but a novel of quality will be published no matter what?
No, a non-commercial novel of quality will not be published, and that's what the small independent houses have been doing and doing very well. Translations will not happen. I did a very careful analysis for the Chronicle the other month of the catalogs of Random, Simon & Schuster, and Harper to see what, you know, these 500 books represented. And in those 500 titles, you know, they were literally not a single translation. There was not a single history book which could be called history. There was no scientific popularization of any serious kind. There were about three books on politics, and the rest were how-to popular fiction and bestsellers and so on and so forth.
But we get books all the time on scientific matters. Brian Greene had a bestseller, didn't he, recently?
Well,
lot of historians come
by. No,
you
do, but they don't necessarily come from the large conglomerates. If you look at the catalogs, as I'm sure you do, it's interesting to see the dogs that aren't barking anymore. I was shocked. I mean, I've been critical of the conglomerates for some time, and when I wrote this article, I was surprised.
What amazes me is how many classics are not available in paperback.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, here again,
used to be any book,
right?
Especially if it was public domain,
right? And this is what comes when you're trying to change your percentage of profit. A memo came to me at Random while I was still there, saying any book that's selling under 2,000 copies a year should be pulped. I mean, not even remaindered, but pulped, as if it had some virus that would infect the rest of the books in the warehouse and cause them to stop, shrivel up and stop selling. So that, you know, a lot of the major books we had published, novels by Cortázar or Marguerite Duras or whatever, were pulped after we left. Now, those are books that could still make money. The cost had been
put them in a warehouse, and eventually they'll sell.
Exactly. But what what is happening is that people really feel we have to concentrate on only those books from which we can guarantee a large profit.
Now, one of the big five publishing conglomerates is a German firm, Bertelsmann. Do they bring a more European sensibility to American publishing?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, Sonny Mehta claims in an article in the New York, in an interview in the New York Observer, that there were 4,000 accountants at the Bertelsmann headquarters. If that's true, that is a different kind of sensibility. And the inside gossip I hear from Random House is that people are suffering a little bit from the fact that they're under a much stricter, and I think one could call it Germanic, kind of control over expenditures and so on. But in terms of the nature of their publishing, one of Germany's leading literary critics, Hans Magnus Enzensberger, once told me that he had been reading Bertelsmann's books for the last 50 years, and he couldn't think of a single title he could remember. So the literary quality was not as high as that had obtained before at Random and Knopf.
You think that the end of the Cold War has had a negative effect on publishing?
It has in a curious way.
Now, Bertelsmann is in the country that was the border in the Cold War.
Right, and part of the problem is that everyone has now acknowledged that, in effect, this is an era of American hegemony. English is the language for the whole world, and you have to publish in English. So French firms and German firms and so on have bought into American publishing, sometimes at very great risk, in order to break out of the small German market. I remember when I first started going for the Frankfurt Book Fair, some 40 years ago, I still felt I had to try to speak German to people. Now when you do that, people look at you in surprise, and of course many of them were Turkish or Indian or whatever anyway, and don't speak German themselves. But English has become the language, and that's why Bertelsmann was willing to buy a firm that was losing a lot of money in order to make that entrance.
Why has the end of the Cold War caused a problem? Is it just quickening a downward slide, or has something else happened as a result?
Well, you're talking about a very complicated and interesting phenomenon there, and some historians have begun to talk about the American triumphalism that has come after the end of the Cold War, just as it came after the end of the Second World War. And I think you get two resulting phenomena which are complementary. I mean, one of them is that there is the feeling that we know best, we've won, we don't really need to learn from other people. And so the impetus to try to translate, to try to publish books from other countries, to look critically at the U.S. has diminished enormously. We've just published an interesting book on human rights called Crimes Against Humanity by an English barrister called Robertson. The Washington Times yesterday came out, and that's why I remember it, with a huge review saying, here is the rest of the world, in effect, trying to attack American sovereignty. So if you raise the question of whether the Pinochets of this world should be imprisoned, your attack, and this is by a former assistant secretary of state, not just some kook, you're attacking American sovereignty. So that's a strong mood.
But on the other side, there are problems. Writers from the former communist countries complain that the end of government support of cultural matters has led to a lowering of standards. One person told me the minute the Berlin Wall came down, everybody wanted porn, and they were no longer ready to buy Krzysztof Wolff novels.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was invited by the Polish publishing community to visit 10 years ago at the time of the change, 1990, and it was fascinating. Every street corner had a little stand where you could buy the latest Jeffrey Archer, very often in a pirated edition, but you literally could not get the great national classics anymore, which had been subsidized by the government in those years. You went into a bookstore, you could not find Sienkiewicz or the other great Polish writers. And conversely, the American interest in East Europe and Latin America and so on, which had been part of the Cold War, we needed to know what they thought, we needed to persuade them we were right. That has disappeared too, so you get very little translated now from Eastern Europe.
What about the CIA, which used to prop up a lot of American cultural exchange,
right,
we
indeed
have discovered from one of your books?
Right, and the CIA and the Cultural Cold War by Francis Saunders has a very interesting and well-written description of how much money was spent in that. And it is fascinating to see how much stuff was published that was intended theoretically for distribution in Europe, but was really meant to influence U.S. public opinion, and did so very successfully.
But a lot of very good writers benefited from it.
They did, even though they were probably embarrassed later on to find out who was translating them. But if you look now, I mean, it gives you some idea of what's happened to American publishing, that the leading translator of literature from Eastern Europe is now Northwestern University Press, and the leading translator of French fiction is Nebraska.
Well, Michael Nauman tried to bring a European sensibility to American publishing when he headed Henry Holt. He brought in an impressive list of authors and then lost a lot of money for his company, and he's now out of publishing altogether. He's a minister in Gerhard Schroeder's government in Germany.
Right. Well, he's the Minister of Culture, which is not a bad career move. But I think part of the problem...
But everybody was glad to see him go, I understand, because even though he brought in a lot of good writers, the company was bleeding money.
Right. But Michael was indeed trying to play the American game, and what he had been persuaded of, and perhaps not inaccurately, is that the way to establish, in this case, Holt as a major player was to overpay. Mm-hmm. And so he bought Salman Rushdie and others for much more than he should have, but that's what everybody else had been doing.
And not necessarily their greatest books. It's better to overpay when a book is going to sell a million copies over 10 years than if it's going to sell 20 copies.
Right, but if you look at why Random House lost so much money that it had to sell out to Bertelsmann, you'll see that part of the problem is that they were overpaying for Nancy Reagan and Donald Trump and a lot of other people who make Rushdie look like Tolstoy by comparison. You know, we have to say, in all fairness, that on a much smaller scale at Holt, my former colleague Sarah Burstell has run Metropolitan Books, which has done a whole series of very good, very serious, very worthwhile books, which has not lost money. So doing good stuff doesn't mean losing money, far from it.
Well, as long as there are smart, curious, and literate people, won't there always be a market for good books?
There is a market, and part of what we set out to do with the new press was to show that there was a market for these books, there was an audience, and you could, in fact, create a market. That there were instances where, as with the Supreme Court volumes we talked about, where no one thought there would be an audience, where there was a very substantial audience. The problem with the firms being run by the financial people as they are now is they want a guaranteed profit and they want a guaranteed bestseller. They want you to stick to the well-known, acceptable models. And the bookstores increasingly will also look to see what did the author's last book sell. By definition, there is no track record for a new idea, and that's a really dangerous situation.
What is your feeling about the huge bookstores? Some people feel that they're ruining the business. Others point to the fact that if you go into a Barnes & Noble or a Borders, you find a wider selection than you used to find in the local independent.
Well, there's a case to be made on both sides here. I mean, part of the problem, and I talk about it at length in the book, is the whole question of discounting. There was a time when Bennett Cerf was talking where Corvettes, which was an appliance store on Fifth Avenue, was driving the Scribners and Brentanos out of business because they were discounting the bestsellers and not stocking the rest of the stuff. So the independent bookstores will tell you that the real problem has been the discounting and the very heavy support that the chains get. In addition to that, they've been very aggressive in the way they've positioned themselves. So they have driven a lot of small stores out of business. You look at New York City, I have a chart in the book that says that in the 1940s we had 333 bookstores in New York City. We have barely a tenth of that now.
When Barnes & Noble calls up and says we want to buy 20,000 copies of your book, you don't say, no, I want to support the independent bookstores, do you?
Right. Well, they didn't give me that dilemma.
They haven't put you into that bind yet.
They've bought a half a copy per store so far. There's no question that in many towns they offered bookstores where none existed, and they offered a choice where none existed. The unfortunate thing is that it's been done at the cost of the independents.
Andre Schifrin's a publisher. He is the head of an independent publishing company, The New Press. But another independent company, Verso, which is British originally.
It is still British, yeah.
Verso is the American arm.
It is, right.
Verso has published The Business of Books. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.